The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're here on the last day of the work week. Friday is already upon us. The last couple of weeks, really, going before these couple lectures I've put together for a group here in Edmond. I've talked some on the program, this program, about what's been happening in Britain this past year and a couple of statements that my father has been making about the decline of Great Britain. Yesterday on the show, I referred to that study, the British Social Attitudes Study, very similar to the Values and Beliefs Study put out by Gallup here in the United States. But this study in the UK talking about the rapidly diminishing views or traditional views regarding same-sex marriage and fornication and pornography and abortion on demand. And this study brings out how that the most dramatic finding, based on interviews with 3,000 people, is that traditional conservative groups like Christians are following along with this trend. It says, and I read this to you yesterday, the majority of Christians now believe there's nothing wrong with sex between unmarried people. And so these are people going to Christian churches in the United Kingdom. And a majority now see that there's nothing wrong with premarital sex. That was from yesterday's program. And then yesterday afternoon I saw this story as well about the number of people living in the United Kingdom who were born overseas. It's now approaching 10%. 5.95 million people, foreign-born residents, living in the UK. It amounts to 9.2%. But it's about double what it was in 2005, just 12 years ago. And it's doubled over that time. So these are some of the stories just from this year, and that's what I've drawn attention to on a few of these radio programs, just what's been happening in 2017. But in getting ready for a couple of lectures I've given here in the Edmond area, I've expanded that study somewhat to just look at what's happened over the past generation or so. You can go back to 1981, the year that Prince Charles married Lady Diana. That happened on July 29th, 1981, and there were, of course, that was a worldwide event. There were something like 750 million people that watched that royal wedding on television. It was the biggest television event in history up until that point. The most popular event ever shown on live television. And, of course, this was, at the time, I mean, it was discussed or talked about as this fairy tale romance. And the whole world watched these two as they came together in their dating relationship, this whirlwind romance. A prince in England marrying this beautiful 20-year-old teacher, kindergarten teacher, Herbert Armstrong at the time. He was writing in The Plain Truth, but he described Lady Diana as bright, cheerful, and happy in appearance. And he mentioned just how popular she was in England, all across the UK. I mean, the English fell in love with Diana almost immediately, perhaps faster than even Prince Charles did. And that's saying a lot. As I said, it was a whirlwind romance. They dated for about 6 months and then got engaged. And then a few months later, they were married in front of the whole world. And writing about that royal wedding in October of 1981, Mr. Armstrong printed this headline for his article. He titled it, Britain's Last Gasp of Joy and Splendor This was their last gasp of joy and splendor. He was talking about it as if it was the beginning of the end for the House of Windsor. And then at that same time, this is also October of 1981, he made this comment in passing. This was a sermon that he gave back in October 23rd, 1981. And he made this comment about that royal wedding. This is clip 7.
I don't know whether you noticed or not, but the recent royal wedding in England, I was over there at the time. And in that wedding ceremony, there was nothing that the wife had to obey the husband. That was all left out. Oh, it was going to be 50-50. Well, let's watch and see whether it lasts or not.
That was Herbert Armstrong back in 1981 talking about the family government, talking about a statement in the royal wedding, a statement that had been there traditionally, but not in this one, not in 1981. And he said there, well, let's wait and see whether or not this marriage even lasts. Now, I don't think there were too many commentators at the time witnessing this fairy tale romance. I don't think there were too many commentators that were sounding that kind of an alarm, saying that, look, if you take away that family government, that marriage is not going to work. He said at the time, going back to that Britain's last gasp of joy and splendor, Mr. Armstrong said, I do not know whether the present generation of the royal family know and believe it, but I've been informed that the royal family of two or three generations ago did know that the British sovereign is in fact a continuation of the dynasty of King David of ancient Israel. They used to know this. We've talked before about this very truth on the program. We've produced videos on it back in, 2014, I think it was. We produced, I think, 3 or 4 videos on this royal history, on the fact that the British sovereign was a continuation, as Mr. Armstrong said there in 1981, a continuation of the dynasty of King David. King David, I mean, in Mr. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, he talked about that royal throne, King Edward's chair in Westminster Abbey, the chair under which the stone of destiny, it sat there, well, for centuries, right up until 1996. Well, there was a sign, right alongside that stone that said Jacob's Pillar Stone, referring back to Genesis 28, something that happened way back in the first book of the Bible. Jacob's Pillar Stone. Quite a few people, up until just this most recent generation, quite a few people believe that that was the stone, Jacob's Pillar Stone. Well, as you well know, so many of you, that sign was removed at some point after 1981. That's the last version of the United States and Britain in Prophecy. The sign was removed. And then, of course, in 1996, the stone itself was removed. And it was moved up to Scotland. My father, at the time of that removal, he wrote, and this is now in the Jeremiah booklet, but he said, Queen Elizabeth II sent the stone of David's throne to Scotland, and he went on to talk about how that stone symbolized Jesus Christ himself. And he said, now they've lost their protector. Britain gave up their protector. My father said, perhaps the queen doesn't understand how she made her throne vulnerable to Satan's attack. Satan is now attacking that throne as never before. He said the queen could hardly have made a bigger mistake. That was his statement. A strong one there in 1996 or soon after. Just as strong as the one Mr. Armstrong made in 1981. Well, let's see how long this marriage lasts. And then after giving up the stone, my father said, look, this couldn't have been a bigger mistake. And now look at what's happened. Look at what's happened since they removed that statement about obedience from the marriage ceremony. Since they removed the stone of destiny, Jacob's pillar stone, in 1996. That was the same year, by the way, that Prince Charles and Princess Diana officially divorced. And Prince Charles's brother, by the way, Prince Andrew, he divorced Sarah Ferguson in 1996. Of course, the year after that, 1997, that's when Princess Diana died in that horrific car accident in Paris. And then you go right down the line. 1999, Prince Charles came out and said that, you know, there was discussion on what the next coronation would be like. Speaking of language, you know, like the language in that wedding ceremony from 1981. I mean, if you go back and look at some of those old coronation ceremonies, I mean, the British sovereign is there to defend the Church of England, to defend the Holy Bible, to defend the faith. Well, Prince Charles came out in 1999 and said that he wanted to be a defender of faith rather than a defender of the faith. Multiculturalism. I'm sure he's going for, if he gets this opportunity, a multi-faith kind of coronation. As I say, you go back to some of those old coronations. You can go back to this present queen's coronation in 1953. In that coronation, she swore to maintain in the United Kingdom the Protestant Reformed religion established by law. That was the oath that she took. And look at all that's happened since then. Queen Elizabeth II reaching out to the Pope, to the Vatican. Pope John Paul visiting England or Britain back in 1982. Trying to bring the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church together. This great reconciliation. It goes right against the oath that this present queen, this present monarch took back in 1953. More recently, if you look at the position that this current queen took in 2013, this is just a few years ago, she came out in support of same-sex marriage. Here's this woman sitting on David's throne, or what was David's throne? God's throne. And what an opportunity she had to proclaim the truth about marriage and family. Instead, she came out and offered a strong endorsement for same-sex marriage. That was a few years ago. Now, more recently, as I've pointed out a few times on this program, my father made a statement back in February, and then more recent than that, in May, he made a statement in messages that the UK is going to be going down very fast, including the royal family. They've given up their protector. They've abandoned their protector. And look at what's been happening since my father's been making these statements. So much division in government between England and Scotland. And now more recently between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. And then all these terrorist attacks. You had the Muslim terrorist in March mowing down those pedestrians on Westminster Bridge. And then continuing his attack in the Houses of Parliament. 5 people killed, 50 people injured. That was March 22nd, just a week before Britain gave its formal notice that it intends to leave the EU. And so the clock is ticking. Britain now has less than 2 years as it breaks apart from the European Union, something that Herbert Armstrong prophesied something that Herbert Armstrong mentioned back in the 1950s and reiterated again in his final work, Mystery of the Ages. Britain's not going to be part of it. That's based on a number of prophecies. But coming back to what's been happening in the UK and in the royal family just this year, March 30th, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and then Prince Harry, they announced that they're going to be stepping up their heads together campaign. This is a campaign where they talk about the struggles that they've had or that they've discussed regarding mental health. This is the great cause that they're taking up. They want to make people aware of mental illness, mental health issues. This clip here that I have is of Prince Harry in an interview that he had about this Heads Together campaign. This is clip two.
I mean, do you have experience with mental health issues or...
Yeah, I mean, I think especially over this, the beginning of this campaign and previously, I think if anybody looked at my life, I can't speak for the other two, obviously. They've got their own reasons. But for me specifically, if you look at back to the fact that I lost my mum at the age of 12 mm-hmm. on the sort of public platform of which it was, and then everything else that happens of being in the spotlight and this sort of role and the pressures that come with it, and then going to Afghanistan and then working in the personnel recovery unit with all of the soldiers as well, and taking on a lot of their issues, anybody would look at that and go, okay, there must be something wrong with you. You can't be totally normal. There must be something wrong. And I sort of buried my head in the sand for many, many years. And some people have written about it and suggested that, you know, there might be something wrong with me and it might be Afghanistan related. I can safely say it's not Afghanistan related. I'm not one of those guys that has had to, you know, see my best mate blown up next to mm-hmm. me and have to apply a tourniquet to both their legs. Luckily, you know, thank God I wasn't one of those people. But I can safely say that losing my mum at the age of 12 and therefore shutting down all of my emotions for the last 20 years mm-hmm. has had a quite serious effect on not only my personal life, but also my work as well.
That's Prince Harry in an interview that he had back in April, and this is around the time he has this landmark interview also with the Daily Telegraph, talking about some of the things that you heard there in that clip, the struggles that he's had with his own mental health issues, shutting down all of his emotions after his mother died, I'm sure a traumatic experience and such. But here is Prince Harry, along with his brother, Prince William, and the Duchess of Cambridge. This is their great cause now that they want to make known. Prince William, he released a video around the same time as this Telegraph piece came out talking about Prince Harry's struggles. He released this this staged video on April 17th, I think it was, where he had this exchange with Lady Gaga over Skype or FaceTime or whatever it is. But they're also discussing this Heads Together campaign. They're talking about the struggles that so many have with mental health. Here's a bit from that exchange. This is clip three.
How you found speaking out and how it made you feel?
It made me very nervous at first. For me, waking up every day and feeling sad and going on stage is something that is very hard to describe. There's a lot of shame attached to mental illness. You feel like something is wrong with you. And in my life, I go, oh my goodness, look at all these beautiful, wonderful things that I have, and I should be so happy. But you can't help it if in the morning when you wake up, you are so tired, you are so sad, you are so full of anxiety and the shakes that you can barely think. But it was like saying, this is a part of me. And that's okay.
It's interesting to see and hear from you how much having that conversation or having that sort of that ability to speak to someone really made a difference to you. And I think for me, the little bits that I've learned so far about mental health is very much the case of, you know, it's okay to have this conversation. It's really important to have this conversation and that you know, you won't be judged. It's so important to break open that fear and that taboo, which is it's only going to lead to more problems down the line.
Yes. It can make a huge difference. I feel like we are not hiding anymore. We're starting to talk.
That's Prince William's trying to bring this pop star into it, Lady Gaga, to solve the problems of mental health. Of course, we know, we touched on some of this yesterday. The problem here is Satan's broadcast and the fact that he's been cast down, Revelation 12. And you bring in Ephesians 2 and verse 2. Him surcharging the air with his attitudes and impulses and moods. And those discussing this, as you just heard, know nothing about that, of course. And so they're trying to figure out how that they can help this world in all of its mental health issues. These are individuals that, as Mr. Armstrong said in that 1981 article, that used to understand that they were a continuation of the dynasty of King David of ancient Israel. And look at what they're getting involved in, so many of them. I'll have more to say on that in just a second. But you look at the division also in government there in the UK. Theresa May back in, April 18th, I think it was, when she announced the snap elections. They were going to have elections in less than 2 months. Here's the Prime Minister back in April, clip one.
I have just chaired a meeting of the Cabinet where we agreed that the government should call a general election to be held on the 8th of June. I want to explain the reasons for that decision, what will happen next, and the choice facing the British people when you come to vote in this election. Last summer, after the country voted to leave the European Union, Britain needed certainty, stability, and strong leadership. And since I became Prime Minister, the government has delivered precisely that.
Now, what's amazing about that particular clip is just how fast things have changed politically in the UK. She called for those elections because she thought it was certain that she would gain more seats in Parliament. She knew at that time, that was April 18th, she knew that Jeremy Corbyn was seen as such a radical. He came from the far, far left. I mean, he's a proud communist. And she thought, surely this is an opportunity for me to expand my base, to get more of a majority in Parliament. Well, and I think we know what it was that happened. I'll get into that more when we come back after the break. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. When the British government gave the Stone of Destiny back to Scotland in 1996, it captured media headlines around the world. But none of the reporting explained the God-inspired history of Britain's Stone of Destiny. This incredible true story is told in Herbert Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Nothing embodies the history and prophecy of the British peoples quite like Britain's Stone of Destiny. Yet many have forgotten this vital history. Request The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm. For more information, visit our website, thetrumpet.com. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
Good evening, everyone. I'm sorry that I can't be with you all this evening, but I hope you're having a wonderful time. I'd like to say a huge thank you to everyone at the LGBT Awards for this incredible award. It's a real honour to be recognised in this way. In recent years, I've become passionate about what we can do to protect people from bullying, particularly online. Through this work, I've encountered a number of tragic stories about LGBT young people who have sadly felt unable to cope with the abuse and discrimination they face in their lives. But this work has also led me to a number of inspiring people who are helping others to stand up to bullying wherever it occurs. It is 2017, and no one should be bullied for their sexuality or any other reason. It's so important to be proud of the person you are. I am very proud to receive this Ally Award. Thank you and have a good evening.
That's Prince William from May 12th, just a month and a half ago, receiving the Straight Ally of the Year Award. That's at the British LGBT Awards ceremony. He's there on this this video, accepting this award, talking about another passion that the House of Windsor has. You heard about the love for, or at least the passion to make people aware of mental health issues. And here's another passion that the Prince, this continuation of David's dynasty, he wants to eliminate bullying, and he's very proud of the attention that he's brought to, the positive attention he sees it as he's brought to the LGBT community. That was in May. May also, by the way, there was this BBC special or movie put together by the BBC, King Charles III, it was called. It was a fairly controversial film, for some obvious reasons, but it was basically a story about the next king of England after Queen Elizabeth dies. And basically this film was about the downfall of the royal family, a family that's haunted by the ghost of Princess Diana. You see the ghost of Diana throughout this film. That ran in May of this year, and it was around about this time when the royal family started talking about all of the initiatives it was taking, the Heads Together campaign, Prince William accepting this Straight Ally of the Year from the British LGBT community, this BBC film, King Charles III. It was around this time that Spectator, there was a piece at the Spectator, made in Windsor, it said, how Kate, William, and Harry became Britain's biggest reality TV show. And the article talked about Prince Harry seen kissing his celebrity girlfriend at a polo match, this Hollywood actress, and how that Prince William was suing a French magazine for publishing pictures of his wife without a top on. It talked about Pippa Middleton, she's the sister of the Duchess of Cambridge, and how that she married an individual who's the brother of a reality TV star. And the Spectator says here, the younger royals are just too interested in the cringe-inducing world of celebrity and in the popularization of their own image. At times, it's hard to tell the difference between the real-life entertainment provided by the princes, and those structured reality shows, such as Made in Chelsea and The Only Way is Essex, in which fake people act out real and trivial events, which become drawn-out sagas. These are popular reality shows in the UK, Made in Chelsea, The Only Way is Essex. Fake people acting out real events, trivial events at that. Is the royal family in Britain now becoming just another reality show? Well, they sure seem to love celebrity. They sure seem to love the attention. They sure seem to blend in well with the actors and the actresses and the pop stars and the sports stars. Well, along the way, as I mentioned in the first segment, while all this is going on, you have these terrorist attacks, one after another after another. The Westminster Bridge attack in March, as I said. And then you had the terrorist who blew himself up at that pop concert in Manchester, May 22nd. 23 people murdered, over 100 injured, maimed, deformed because of this explosion, because of this terrorist attack. Late in May, there was another story. This was, I think, in Newsweek, about Prince Harry, once again, and his so-called bromance with former U.S. President Barack Obama. The two were pictured together at Kensington Palace. And they talked about their support for veterans, mental health, empowering young people. It said in Newsweek, Obama's visit to the U.K. came less than a week after a suicide bomb attack at the Ariana Grande concert at Manchester Arena. That was late May. We talked a lot in late May, too, about the division, the oncoming division between the European Union and the United States and also the UK following that visit to the continent by the U.S. President Donald Trump. And then some of the comments from the German Chancellor in particular. After Mr. Trump left, Chancellor Merkel talking about how that we Europeans, we've got to take our destiny into our own hands. And we've got to fight for our own future. We can't worry so much about America or Britain. That's really what she was saying. And of course, this too is something that's prophesied. We've talked about this coming split between the United States and Europe. We've talked about NATO, basically, being disbanded. And Germany taking the lead. That's happening. Well, then coming back to UK politics, you'll remember Theresa May called for those snap elections back in April, thinking that she surely would get a bigger majority, and it didn't work out so well. And coming right up to the election, June 8th, which just shocked the world, Jeremy Corbyn receiving 40% of the vote. Here's someone that, I mean, has such extreme views. He didn't win the majority. Theresa May still maintained a majority, a very slim one at that. She had to form an alliance with the far right-wing party up in Northern Ireland just to have a majority. But this is from a Trumpet brief. I've quoted this before. This is Richard Palmer writing about the UK elections in June. He said, he talked about how that before the elections, Jeremy Corbyn was seen as an extremist. He was booed by his own party. Some of them wanted him to just leave. And then coming up to those elections, I mean, everything just totally flip-flopped. He said that when Jeremy Corbyn entered into Parliament following that election, he was greeted by a standing ovation. It was just a stunning election result. And it followed right after another terrorist attack. That vehicular terrorist attack on the London Bridge. Three attackers killing, murdering 8 people, injuring 48 more. And that was on June 3rd, after which the London mayor got on television. I played this exchange before, but he got on TV, Good Morning Britain, and basically said, well, you know, there's no way we can possibly follow all of these former ISIS fighters that have since come back to Britain. Here again is that exchange between Mayor Khan and Piers Morgan on Good Morning Britain. This is clip 5.
To be cutting resources from
where
those...
where are they? The mayor of this capital
respect,
city. Where are they?
I can't follow 400 people. What I can do is make sure
why
the policies... what we can do, though, is make sure we've got the resources for the police and the experts to follow these people.
Why can't you instruct the police? Why can't you call Cressida Dick right now and say every one of those people who's come back from a war zone, who's in London, I want them followed?
Let me see why. Because the Met Police budget, roughly speaking, 15% to 20% is funded by me, the mayor. The rest comes from central government. If the Met Police budget is being shrunk and reduced, they've got to prioritise and use their resources in a sensible, savvy way.
What could be a bigger priority than people coming back from a Syrian battlefield with intent to harm British citizens? Why is it not the number one priority? Why are these people just allowed to come back in the first place, and then the London mayor doesn't appear to have a clue where any of them are? I mean, no disrespect to you, but where are they?
Well, that's one of the questions that obviously...
Where are they? He doesn't seem to know. He doesn't seem to know. And so the terrorist attacks continue on. And other tragedies, too. The Grenfell Tower, that burned down June the 14th. We talked about that some on the program as well. Dozens of people dying in that tragedy. And then Jeremy Corbyn quickly using the tragedy as an opportunity to attack conservatives. Melanie Phillips wrote about this on June 20th. She said the fire is being exploited in a sectarian and cynical way to fuel public anger and provoke disorder. What's behind all of this? What is happening in the UK? I mean, it's leading to a class war, Melanie Phillips brings out. Well, she talks about how that this radical left and its attack on the Conservative Party, I mean, it was strategizing long before the Grenfell Tower burned down. Melanie Phillips says it's clear that the hard left thinks it now has the chance to mount a coup, aided and abetted by large sections of the media, which have presented Corbyn's election as a victory. They've set out to foment insurrection on the streets in order to overturn the result. This strategy was plotted before the Grenfell fire. Now it's enabling these agitators to incite hatred and violence by claiming that the Tories didn't just steal the election, but have committed murder. That's what Theresa May's critics are saying. Well, they're guilty of murder. It's similar to what the radical left is saying in the United States about the Republican plan to just water down Obamacare ever so slightly. They're going to murder people. They want people to die. It's the same approach, the same strategy in the UK. Look at how fast it's changed just in the couple of months since Theresa May called for new elections. Well, now that's happened, and Jeremy Corbyn's gained quite a lot of power. We've played some bits from Tim Farron's resignation as well. That happened, as it turns out, on the same day of the Grenfell fire. This is the leader of the Liberal Democrats talking about how impossible it was for him to lead a major political party in Britain and to be a devout Christian. He just couldn't do both at the same time. He couldn't be a Christian and lead the Liberal Democrats. Here's some of what Mr. Farron said on June 14th, clip 6.
From the very first day of my leadership 2 years ago, I have faced questions about my Christian faith. I've tried to answer with grace and patience. Sometimes my answers could have been wiser. At the start of this election, again, I found myself under scrutiny, asked about matters to do with my faith. I felt guilty that the focus was distracting attention from our campaign, obscuring our message. Now, journalists have got absolutely every right to ask whatever they see fit. The consequences of the focus on my faith is that I have found myself torn between living as a faithful Christian and serving as a political leader. A better, wiser person than me may have been able to deal with this more successfully, to remain faithful to Christ while leading a political party in the current environment. To be a political leader, especially of a progressive liberal party in 2017, and to live as a committed Christian, to hold faithfully to the Bible's teaching, has felt impossible for me. Now, I am a liberal to my fingertips, and that liberalism means that I am passionate about defending the rights and liberties of people who believe very different things to me. There are Christians in politics who take the view that they should impose the tenets of their faith on society, but I have not taken that approach because I fundamentally disagree with it. It is not liberal, and actually it's counterproductive when it comes to advancing the gospel. Even so, I seem to have been the subject of suspicion because of what I believe and who my faith is in. In which case, we are kidding ourselves if we think we yet live in a tolerant, liberal society. And that's why I have chosen to step down as leader of the Liberal Democrats.
We're fooling ourselves if we think that we're living in a liberal, tolerant society, he said there at the end. Here he's become the subject of suspicion. He's a liberal right through to the end of his fingertips, he said. A proponent of abortion rights, same-sex marriage, all those things. All those popular far-left positions. And yet he is also a devout Christian. And so the left-wing media, I mean, they just wouldn't stand for it. They were harassing him all through the campaign. And he finally came out and concluded, I mean, I think it's impossible for me to lead a major political party. As much as I love the liberal Democrats, I've been a part of this party since I was 16. As much as I love them, I can't lead them because I'm a Christian. And there are those in our society who simply will not tolerate that. And so the radical left-wing media, they ran him out of town. That's Britain, modern-day Britain, Britain of 2017. That happened, as I say, the same day as that tragic fire there in West London, Grenfell, the tower, that burned down. And Jeremy Corbyn's party, of course, seizing upon that opportunity in a cynical way to fuel public anger, to provoke division. I mean, Corbyn came out and said that we should just seize control of rich properties, rich vacation properties that are sitting vacant. We should just take control of them, seize control of property in Britain, in London, so that the poor people can live there. That's the leader of the far-left party in Britain. He just got 40% of the vote, so many of them young people. Well, more recently, this was just a little over a week ago, I guess, you had the car ramming, the revenge strike by that British citizen aimed at Muslims. Ramming his car into a crowd of Muslims, I guess at the end of, I think it was at the end of Ramadan, June the 18th. And the day before that, it was interesting, I saw some clips from this birthday celebration for the Queen. This was on June the 17th. In a lot of ways, looking at it on television, it was this impressive, I mean, a very royal gathering there at, I think it was St. James Park. And then the Queen and her carriage and all of the royal guards. This procession, this grand royal procession as it made its way back to Buckingham Palace. But it was also a somber occasion in many ways. Ahead of this celebration, the Queen came out with a statement. I think Richard Palmer has brought this to your attention before. But she said in this statement that, you know, traditionally this is a day of celebration. This year, she says, this year, however, it's difficult to escape a very somber national mood. In recent months, the country has witnessed a succession of terrible tragedies. I mean, we've just witnessed all kinds of tragedies. It's hard to celebrate anymore in Britain. She said, as a nation, we continue to reflect and pray for all those who've been directly affected by these events. And she goes on and talks about the reaction from so many in Britain and their willingness to help and to comfort those that have suffered. But it was a very somber national mood at this birthday celebration on June 17th. And just a few days after that, as is traditional, there was the Queen opening up the new session in Parliament. This is from June 21st, just a little over a week ago. And this, too, typically is a magnificent procession. And yet this time around, the Queen, she just arrived in a regular old car. No horse-drawn carriage. No royal procession. She just, rather than all of the royal robes, she just wore a day dress and a hat, no crown. The Telegraph The Daily Telegraph says there were no horse-drawn carriages, empty spaces yawned on the pier's back benches. The order of procession was full of holes. Traditionally, at the state opening, the Queen is a vision to which the TV cameras never do justice. The imperial state crown, the 18-foot robe of the state, and a glittering galaxy of diamonds. This time, she was wearing a blue coat, and instead of a crown, a blue floral hat. Perhaps it was all meant to reflect this very somber national mood in Britain. Perhaps she didn't want to provoke any additional public anger or division. In any event, you see the direction. You see the direction for the UK and for the royal family. It's disturbing. It should be. Anyone who has just a basic awareness of history. The same day as that order of procession, or the state opening, rather, Newsweek came out with a piece. This was from June 21st as well. And it got quite a bit of coverage on both sides of the pond, particularly in the UK, of course. Prince Harry coming out saying that, you know, I don't know if there's anyone in the royal family who really even wants to rule. I don't know if there's anyone in our family that wants to be king or queen next. Notice how Newsweek described this family, the House of Windsor. It talks about Prince Harry's parents, Charles and Diana. It says here, his parents were a horrible mismatch, and they separated after a fairy tale turned nightmare marriage of 11 years. Charles went back to his longtime lover, Camilla Parker Bowles. Diana had a variety of lovers, the last of whom was Dodi Fayed, the son of Muhammad Al-Fayed, the former owner of megastore Harrods. He died with her in that car crash in Paris. When asked about his family, Harry talks readily about the Queen. She's so remarkable. And his late mother, she had the most wonderful sense of humor and always wanted to make things fun for us as well as protect us. He says less about William and Kate and almost nothing about his father or stepmother. That's what Newsweek has to say about a prince. He has nothing to say, almost nothing to say about his father or his stepmother. You see, it was a dysfunctional family from the beginning, and Mr. Armstrong noted that in 1981. Okay, you remove the family government in 1981, or you remove it from that ceremony, and then what happens? The marriage won't work. The family won't work. And now we see the products. We see the fruits that have come out from that. This Newsweek article talks about the prince wanting to be something other than a prince. He's not happy being a prince. He wants to be something else. He wants to be just a regular guy. They're involved in modernizing the British monarchy. Yes, they are. That's why they're coming together for the Heads Together campaign. That's why you have a prince accepting an award from the LGBT community. That's what it means to modernize the royal family in Britain today. Newsweek quotes Prince Harry as saying, is there any one of the royal family who wants to be king or queen? I don't think so. I don't think any of us even want to be king or queen. That's Britain today. Now you go back to what my father said in February and then again in May. It's going down fast. The Spectator, going back to that piece from, I think this was April, where it was talking about the reality show, remember? The film on BBC. And all the celebrities. The Heads Together campaign. Lady Gaga. The LGBT award, etc., etc. It says here, the play, Charles III, I guess this TV show was made after a play on Broadway, or at least in the West End there. The play Charles III, broadcast this week on television, portrays the next king as a meddlesome monarch who loses his crown by interfering too much in politics. This scenario reflects a long-standing fear among monarchists that the Prince of Wales will undo all his mother's good work because he cannot keep his mouth shut. It says here Prince William and Prince Harry are widely reckoned to be more popular than their father, but if they keep fishing for empathy and dabbling in celebrity culture, the public will grow weary of them. It says in 30 years' time, royal historians might look back at the Heads Together campaign, at the eager association with pop stars, and the blooming romance between Prince Harry and Miss Markle and ask, was this the moment when it all started to go wrong? That's what the Spectator asked. Is this the moment it all started to go wrong? Really, you can go back earlier than that. You can go back to 1996 when they gave up the protector. You can go back to 1981 when they removed the word obey. And you can see, if your eyes are open to what's happening, you can see that it's all going wrong. You can take note, just a little study into this history. You can see when it started to go off track. How could you deny it today? And just think here as we conclude this program. I mean, just think about, you have a lot of commentators. You have a lot of chatter. I read to you from The Spectator, from Newsweek. But which commentators? You go back to what happened in 1981 and what Mr. Armstrong was saying. You go back to what happened in 1996 and what my father was saying. And you think then about the commentators that have just been spot on. Mr. Armstrong talked about Britain not being a part of the EU. He also, throughout the 50s and 60s, he talked about Britain being reduced to a second-rate power in the world. Has that happened? It's worse than that. It's worse than that. He talked about Britain's entry into the European community, how it portends a tragic situation. It's not going to work out. Who was saying that in 1973? Who was talking about the royal wedding in 1981 the way that Mr. Armstrong was? Well, you got some commentary that was spot on in 81 and 96, and along the way, from this church, in Mr. Armstrong's writings, because of the many prophecies of God that talk about the people of Britain, that talk about the people of Ephraim, that talk about, in the case of Hosea 2, for example, all of the wealth, all of the blessings, all of the prosperity, the corn, the wine, the oil, the multiplied silver and gold, all of this power, all of this wealth. And yet, as it says in that same prophecy, that same passage, our people, the people of Ephraim, they don't know where the abundance came from. They don't know that it came from God. And God is now withdrawing those blessings. The people of Britain, they need to wake up to what's happening. To what's happening in the world, for sure, but to what's happening in their own nation. Right there in their own nation. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week.